And we're live with Kareem Kerr from Madison, Wisconsin. He is the founder and the CEO of One City Schools. It's a organization that does early childhood education and is growing elementary grades after that as a strategic way of improving a longstanding gap between Black, Brown, and White students in Madison, Wisconsin. Kareem, good morning. Thank you for joining.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, man.
So at the outset, you and I were just talking a little bit about if you live at a distance and you hear about Madison, Wisconsin, as I do, I'm in Minnesota, so I'm one state over. So I have a little knowledge of what Madison is. You think, wow, in all Wisconsin, this is the progressive Disneyland. This is the place where things are good for people because you have a college town, lots of educated people.
That's right.
The standard of living is not so bad.
That's pretty good.
I visited twice, I think, and man, it's nice. It's pretty. But the underbelly is kids can't read. Well, when I say kids, I should be more specific. Black children and brown children in Madison are not faring well, which would be the best way for me to put it, when it comes to education and the outcomes there. So what gives? Tell me, how is it possible in a city? You are there, you've grown up there, you went to school there, you've come all the way through the system, you did everything you're supposed to do, you went through elementary, all the way through college there, and you're still there. What's going on there? Tell me what's going on.
You know, there's a report that was put out, it was a study back in, I think it was 1934, by two professors. And in that report, the study, their outcome for African Americans was, and it was called the Negro in Madison is what it was called. It was a published journal article. And they talked about how when we came here, our main thing that we had to do in order to succeed was to assimilate. Don't challenge the power structure and sort of get what you can get. And for most African Americans at that time, that's how they survived in a city like Madison, which even back then, you know, considered itself very progressive. We could live here, but there were certain places we couldn't live. You know, we could engage in public life here, although we couldn't really hold public office. So it was always this, hey, we're glad you're here, but don't challenge us and don't try to be a part of us. And that's my experience, even as a young man growing up here in the 70s and 80s. My family got here in 1907 and has done all kinds of things in Madison, but always pushing and the system constantly pushing back against you. It's only recently that I believe the system, at least the people in the system, because the people are changing finally, where they're more open or becoming more open to allowing us not to just be at a table, but actually to have some authority and some influence at the table. So this is a city where people are like, we love you. We love Black people. We're not racist, but we have sports teams and junior leagues and all these things where you don't see Black kids. And if you do, you always see one, you know, where our kids go to school with Black kids, but their friendship groups have no Black kids anymore. If they do, they were like I was, the popular Black kid who, because he was good at sports or something like that. When you look at their study groups at schools in high school, late middle school, high school, where these children start to mimic their parents, you know, behaviors with, you know, relationships, you start to see they made a play with a little Black kid back in the elementary school. But then there's no Black children in their real peer groups. And so that's something here. And then they hit it, where we would talk about it and they would give you like a brief moment of shine here in the media where they would shine a light on certain things. So that's why I have a lot of history that I've shown people that this stuff has been going on here for a long time, but then they let it go away only until the last 10 years when we tried to get this charter school here. When I came back from Washington, D.C. in 2010, then the community blew up about it. Did we start to see more long-term, honest, sustained reporting on things here? So for Madison, a lot of people are experiencing the racism now and seeing it. It's like their first discovery. I've heard some people say, I had no idea all this was going on here. I'm like, well, it's been going on a long time, people.
You know, I think that was one of the interesting stories that I heard from way back when was that, you know, maybe 10 years ago, that you were at the Urban League, you were proposing a school that would specifically take on the so-called achievement gap, but the gap, racialized gap in achievement specifically for Black students in your area. And I would have to say at that time, I'm sure across the country, there was like this movement towards Black male achievement, focusing on Black male achievement. There were cities like Oakland that were instituting programs specifically at challenging the city on how they were doing with Black boys. And like in many places, you faced an uphill battle in even trying to establish a program to do something good for those students. What was behind the battle to stop you from being able to start a school specifically working with Black students in Madison?
At the core of it, and I didn't see this right away because I thought it was just people's reflux against, you know, against and their reaction to charter schools. But people were saying, I'm not racist. You're calling me a racist. And I'm like, not at one time did I call you guys a racist. There was one point where I did question their ability to move the needle with Black children because they hadn't yet, you know, but it's like this fear of being called something that you actually might be, you know, and not, not wanting to look in the mirror and say, well, what, man, what's the definition of racism when it comes to me? And you stand in people's way, people constantly, you don't let them move forward. It might not even necessarily be intentional, but you are doing it over and over and over again. These folks are coming to the table. There's some smart Black people here, and we got a university town. There's some smart Black people here. And they come and they give you the same response and the same input and the same advice. And, you know, they try to share common ideas with you that we've held for years about how you can help move Black kids forward. But you never really allow them in and you never let them actually help you do it. And so there's this fear that people have here of like being called racist. And they're also, I kept hearing, it's not okay to segregate. It's not okay to segregate. You guys segregate all the time. If you're Black and live here, you would know that. So I would crack up. I would crack up when I would see white colleagues or friends of mine who would say that. But do your friends have any Black friends? Do your kids have any Black friends? Do they hang around any Black kids outside of school? Do you have any Black kids or Black families over for dinner? I mean, things like that. So you talk about segregation, but you're complaining that my school would segregate things. And there was the feminist movement, too, man. They were like, no, we're not going to have anything for boys that we're not going to have for girls. So then we're like, look, we'll do girls, too. We had a plan to do girls, just trying to do one at a time. And so decided to put that forward. And these people still went against it. And so I thought it was a psychosis after a while. I'm like, this the city's psychotic. They will harbor in a gap where 10% of Black kids read at grade level every year for the last 30 years. And they'll call me and want me to come to a committee meeting. But then when we try to do something about it ourselves, all of a sudden something's wrong with us and we're being white supremacists or Black supremacists and we're right wing and all these things that I would hear.
Well, damn, how are you going to be both?
man, you know, it's insane. It's insane. And so that's what my summary is. It's just insanity. And it's still hard for me to identify why, because just everything that's going on now, we got shooting every day, man. And a lot of these young people I know, and some of them would have been in my school because I know I talked to their parents, and they're okay with seeing us on this prison, is this pipeline to prison. And then they'll want to go stand in front and they'll want to go stand with Black people about defund the police. But what about creating institutions that'll help us prevent us from being engaged with the police? Mm-hmm. And they'll go against that. So it's psychotic.
You know, one of the things that kind of always bothers me about a story like yours in starting this school is that there's so much power in being able to say no to a community. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can be doing a bad job with educating a historically marginalized population, mm-hmm. and you are in charge of everything and doing a bad job. But when they try to develop a homegrown solution, you have all the power in the world to say, maybe we will do this. Maybe we won't do this. Nah, right. We don't like that. We don't like you doing that. What is up with the power imbalance? What is the Black community like there? Where was the Black clergy when you were having this issue? Like, what was the response of the Black community to you being denied the opportunity to start a school specifically for Black children?
That's such a great question. When I returned home from DC, you know, I've always been that guy on fire, you know, ready to move and do things. When I became the leader of the Urban League, one of the first things I did is I took two groups of people. We have these beautiful lakes here, and I took them on a boat ride. And you could fit like 30, 40 people on these boats. So I took one boat ride where there was a little bit more diverse group of activists, people in the community, leaders. And I took another one, which is all Black folks. And on it, I had everybody talk about what the vision for Madison could be. Because what I heard in my first 3 months back was that people had no vision here. There were a couple people, but most people hadn't. And it hadn't been because they're not visionaries. It's just visionaries either don't stay here very long, or wouldn't stay here very long because their vision was constantly bumping up against this brick wall of liberal thinking here. Again, how they would define liberal in this city. And they couldn't get anything done. And their kids would struggle. And they were like, nah, I'm done. So then I would leave. So that was one of the reasons why, you know, we the Black community here would lose a lot of its innovators and its visionaries very quickly. Or they would become very quiet and say, I'm done, tired, wore out, and moving on. Then the other is like a lot of our advocates from the 70s and 80s who I recognize as strong leaders in the Black community, they're older, you know, and there's a time and a season for everybody. But that next generation, my generation, wasn't pushing for much. You know, we were trying to be a part of rather than actually create the systems or to change the systems. And so for every one Black person here my age or, you know, a little younger, that was trying to change a system, you had probably seven or eight that were struck, they either stuck in the system or being affected by it, and a couple more that were just trying to survive it. You know, so we didn't have those real revolutionaries, not enough people to push. And then third, there was no avenue really for people to illuminate their voice. But it's been wild because in 10 years, there's a newspaper here called Madison 365 that a childhood friend of mine, Henry Sanders, created. We go back to our diapers, man. And his mom is one of those strong voices, his dad, too. They've all like all these old elders have reemerged now and are really helping to push. So we've got this intergenerational push. But Henry started that newspaper and he's targeting markets like we're talking about, these progressive small cities, where the struggle is real, but the voice is not there. And he's giving us a form and a voice. Plus, we had other papers here like Capital Times, State Journal. They started to say, OK, we better be on this train and be a part of it. So people are hearing more now and seeing more now the activists that have always been here. And this new generation, their voices are getting louder and louder and stronger. And honestly, they're smarter. So, but that was the experience here being Black. It was like to survive here, you either got tired and left, you assimilated, like you just said, all right, I'm done. You gave up, or you went along with it. And it's changing now, though. I'll say that.
It's changing for the better.
Changing for the better. Yeah, it is. It is. You know, it's fun to see my own kids a part of it. But it's unique. It was before George Floyd. It was when Doug Nelson used to be the head of the Annie Casey Foundation in Baltimore, and he's from here. And so when he retired, he came back home and he told me, he said, I was at the Urban League still. It must have been around 2012. He said, Kaleem, he said, you're going to get killed here. He said, I'm aware of these progressive cities. I grew up here. He said, I've got my formative years here. He said, I'm back home. He said, we're going to start something called the Race to Equity Project, where we're going to go around, we're going to do all the deep research to pull the Band-Aid off of what's been going on here. And then we're going to go talk to all the leaders in the community so it's not shocking to them. We're going to push them. And then we're going to go public with it. Well, he did all of that. Mm-hmm. And what he showed was that, man, we look like the deep part of Alabama up in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And people are like, what? Us? It's like, some of y'all have known that for years. You never want to give up any power, any authority. You never want to see that something's wrong with Madison. You got to create, like you said in the beginning, that beautiful image of this city, man. These people worked really hard to create that. And some of them are pissed right now because what's been happening with us for years is now for public view. And let's type in Madison and being Black and you'll see it. And so they're like, oh, giving a bad image of the city. Well, guess what? Image has always been here. You created an image that didn't allow us to get the support or respect we needed. Now we're getting it anyway.
Well, you know, nothing creates a bad image like a bad reality. So if the reality is bad, the image is going to be bad. It's amazing that Madison has had any good image when the reality has been what it's been. I'm looking at this article that you wrote for Madison 365, the paper you just referenced, and it's called Why Black People in Madison Are Impatient and Should Be. And this was like, you know, a stunning bit of background for me because, you know, in your text here, you had lots of interesting things to say. Of course, the text is the setup. But then you have this long list of articles about the Black experience in Madison going back to 1931.
Yeah.
And it, you know, you have like how many, I mean, you have, this is the most comprehensive thing I've seen in any city detailing the Black experience in a city. You have 107 links to stories starting in 1931 and ending up in 2013. I've never seen anything like this, but I don't know how you can have something like this and put it before people in a community and say, this is who we really are and who we've been for a long time and not have any other response except for we need to do better and whatever y'all want to do, let's do it. Right. How was this received? Like when you put this out there, how's this received?
Nobody asked me on a show like you.
I mean, this is deep.
I'm going to tell you, man, I think one person, one reporter reached out to me about it. Other than that, man, nobody, people said it. They saw it on Facebook or whatever. They liked it. They were commenting on it. You know, the same people you would expect to comment on how challenging it is and how bad it is. I mean, they said that. Others who I'm sure it was shocking for said nothing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or I would hear that they were talking about it amongst their friends and it got a lot of visibility. But it's, again, it's that fear to confront what has been going on. And for those my age and older who could have been confronting this, I just turned 49, who could have been confronting this all these years, they're complicit in this because they were in leadership roles while this was going on. And it's like, okay, yeah, you got to address it. And their response is, see, Madison's getting worse. No, Madison's never been really great for us. You got to say that. And you are in power. You had some authority. Why didn't you do things? Why didn't you move harder? Why didn't you move faster? Why didn't you listen more? Why didn't you give up some power? And because there's a lot of people who have been around a long time, I'm assuming that's one of the reasons why I didn't get much personal engagement from it.
Yeah. You know, here in Minnesota, we have this saying. Well, first of all, everybody talks about Minnesota nice. You're our neighbor, you know, right here. So you understand how Midwest works and how we have this image like Madison does of being this, you know, salt of the earth, center of the country, heart of America, good natured, happy, you know, old school Humphrey liberal type of place. And like you all, we are, you know, harboring a gap. Right.
Indeed.
But we say oftentimes, well, at least we're not Mississippi. And I shouldn't say we. I have this rule about not saying we when I'm not included in the we. So I'll say people here often say, well, at least we're not Mississippi and at least we're not Alabama. And they have this vision of the South and the Deep South as being more backwards than we are here. And I like to remind people that we have the Jim Crow of the North going on in Minnesota and that some of the biggest hicks I've ever seen, having grown up in New Orleans and living in Minnesota for a long time, some of the biggest hicks I've ever seen have been very educated people who drink a very fine beer here in Minnesota. Right.
Yes.
And they don't know that they're hicks because they're too busy being metrosexual to know that they're actually hicks. But that's here's right. The thing, like people forget. It's not that they forget. They never know. They're startled when you say things like Minnesota is the second or third worst place in the United States to raise a Black family. It's one of the best places to raise a white family.
Yes, that's mad.
And Wisconsin's number one.
That's right. That's
and I've joked for years. I'm like, we can't even be number one in racism, you know.
Yeah.
But Wisconsin's number one in the worst place to raise a Black family in the country. And it has the nation's biggest Black-white achievement gap in the country, or at least one of the – it's a nation-leading achievement gap for sure. In Madison, in your school district, you know, you got, what, 27,000 kids – 50 schools, 32 elementary schools, 18% of the students are Black. And by all means, you know, Madison's kind of a mixed district. We talk about integration. I mean, 18% Black, 9% Asian, 9% Hispanic, half percent other, you know, multiracial folks. So it's 42% white. So it's kind of the mix that you would say makes a integrated district, even though it's not integrated. But 18% of the students are Black. 57% receiving out-of-school suspensions are Black. 54% receiving in-school suspensions are Black. And students with disabilities are really catching hell. You've had a series of teachers there who have been let go for using racial slurs in the classroom, which I think is kind of an interesting thing. You had one teacher there who's a Black teacher who told a student, "I'm not your nigger." And he got arrested for just telling a student not to call him that name, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah,
I'm just going through some numbers.
I was in there with him when they told him he was getting fired. He called me up.
So crazy.
Yeah, I'm Marlon Anderson, and his son is a head of BSU at that school. It was. He just graduated, Noah. And I couldn't believe it when he told me that. I went to the school, and I was like, wait a minute. This young man who I met, went off on him, and he said, "I'm not your nigger. I'm not." He just said it like that. He said, "You don't call me that."
And well, they fired him for it.
They fired him for it. I was like, "Are you serious?" So we got a little national press for Marlon and got help him get his respect. I don't know if Marlon's back in the school system or not, but it was crazy.
Well, I thought it was interesting to see that, you know, you were interviewed as you were running for school board last year, and one of the questions you got was around this. So I had to look it up, you know, what is this deal? And it, you know, I found a news report that basically said there was a string of teachers in Madison that had been let go for using racial slurs. Those are easy to me. That just talks about an environment in your system or your schools that people wouldn't expect for such a liberal place. But to me, the biggest way to call me a racial slur is in the results. And since 2012, reading proficiency has gone up for Black students by 7%. That takes it up to whopping 19% that are reading proficient. It's went up in math 2%, which gets it up to a whopping 15% that are proficient in math. And an 8%, 12% that graduate and take the ACT that are ready in reading, and 8% that graduate and take the ACT that are proficient in math. Mm-hmm. These all sound like we're number soup when I say them to people, like when I put them out there, but it paints a picture. I think numbers paint a picture. This picture says the gross majority of Black students in Madison are facing futures that are not gonna look nearly as bright as the white students of Madison, which I don't know how you can fix the wealth gap, the job gap, the housing income gap when these are your numbers. Who's really taking that bull by the horn and saying we have to do better?
The previous superintendent, Jen Cheatham, I'll give her some credit. You know, every superintendent has tried to do something. I'm not going to say they haven't. But it's how far they'll push the system forward. Mm-hmm. And she happened to come at a time when our unions in our state were beleaguered, where the voice of teachers unions were diminished dramatically by the Scott Walker administration and what they did overnight that brought 100,000 teachers to the Capitol and their advocates to advocate against the policy they put in place that diminished teachers unions' influence in the state. So she came in with at a time when people are like, you know, not only are we have this race issue now that Kaleem and, you know, is pushing and other people are getting on board with, and we got to do something. Now we've got the largest progressive voice in the city. The teachers union is struggling to find its voice. So she came in at a period where people knew we needed some change and were willing to support a little bit more radical change in the district. And she tried to get the district to all move in a common direction, because Madison used to be a school district where every teacher was sort of doing their own thing, man. They'd implement a new curriculum or whatever, but people would interpret that work themselves however they wanted to. And so, you know, Howard Fuller out of Milwaukee, you know, you always talk about how teachers, you're trying to dance with the lemons, or parents are playing roulette, trying to figure out, you know, which teacher they have to pick for their kid. And if you're in that group that knows who all those teachers are that are really going to move the needle for your kid, then chances of you getting in that classroom, if you have some influence, is good. But a lot of our people here didn't have that kind of influence. Madison, 80% in 2010, a census, 80% of Black people in Dane County were at or below the poverty level. So the level of influence, your voices that we have here, was limited. So we had superintendents try this, but at the end, Jen Cheatham, she got everyone focused on the gap in reading and math, and then she left. And now we have our first African-American superintendent who just started his job a couple of weeks ago, who actually had his roots in education here. He was a principal here, assistant principal, and back in the early 90s, and did his master's degree and graduate degree here, PhD in Madison. He's coming back from your area, the Minnesota area, Dr. Jenkins, and we'll see what happens. But folks here, man, the struggle that they've had is changing the system to do the type of work that needs to get done to help our kids move forward. And those reading scores and things, it comes down to ideology about reading. We don't like direct instruction. We don't like this. We don't like that. And so you could then take them down south or somewhere else where there are some schools that are getting results with our kids. And guess what they're doing? They're doing those things that we keep reacting negatively to. So this ideology around education, this fear of addressing the issue of race and class for fear of being labeled somebody who's harbored this for a long time, and then just the fear of giving up power is real here. And what's interesting is all these people that are actively opposed to segregation are now promoting pods in the middle of the pandemic. Yeah. And guess how many Black kids are going to be in their pod?
Yeah. Yeah, they're privatizing education. Finally,
they're privatizing education right now for their benefit. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, for people in Madison, Wisconsin that are watching, I'm from the outside, so I don't live there. I don't live in Madison, so I'll just like give you the news. You are racist. You have been racist for a long time. You need to get over it. You hold all the power. You are a white supremacist liberal stronghold. You are a progressive stronghold. And because you have the progressive Kool-Aid in your system, you think it's impossible that you might be the person that you actually are. If you have been harboring a gap like this, a racialized gap like this, a segregationist gap like you have, a discipline gap like you have, and you continuously use your power to have the final say on what these students will and won't get, whether or not they'll have a charter school, whether or not they'll have an alternative program, whether or not someone other than you can teach them, whether or not you'll do direct instruction or not. That is what I like to call white power. Your ability to tell another population what they can and can't have and have the final word on it and have zero self-reflection on what you're doing when you do that. Right. Mm-hmm. So here's a voice from the outside. Go ahead. I'm sorry. What'd you say?
Zero accountability for it.
Zero accountability. I watched a school board, Madison school board meeting, where the board was just talking. And like many boards, listen, I'm not going to beat up on your board. And you have some new members since this one that I watched. But like many school boards that I watch, I'm always amazed by who's in control of the decisions of a district, because good Lord, do we have no criteria for the people that actually govern our school districts sometimes. But, you know, in that, there were several white school board members who were going back and forth about, I think this may have been on the, when they were making a decision about a new charter school that was going to be a Montessori charter school. And they were just like, you know, we haven't seen what we like about this proposal. We haven't done this. We haven't done that. We just, you know, I don't know. I need to see more information. And you're one of your Black school board members, I think it was the only one, I'm sure, I'm not sure at the time, said, we don't know. We have to stop acting like we know what we're doing. We have to stop acting like we know how to educate. And every time something new comes up that, you know, we know better. And I thought that was like one of the single most honest reflections that I had seen out of that board. Do you think they're getting more humble now? You know, after Jennifer's been with them, the superintendent that they had who pushed them on these things, do you think? Better now?
I think the slew of the massive amount of advocacy that's taking place in our community now, and it's ever since I came back to the Urban League to lead it in 2010, it's just been picking up steam where people of color in this community are really pushing in ways, in a sustained way, that we had never done before. So they have to pay attention to it. I think it is changing the hearts and minds of more people. More people are willing to confront it and say, you know what, I have been a part of the problem. It's still not a great number yet, but I'm telling you, man, what we've also never had is we've never had a majority of color people leading our board of education. We now have that. And where they don't always see everything the same way, they do work together. And so right now, I think they have a majority of people on the board, I think, you know, at least five of the people who really are pushing to support our community. Four, definitely. I think we have a fifth from how I've seen the votes coming out lately. So I do think there is some progress being made there. But as I keep pushing them, I told one of those board members who I consider to be the most vocal, Ali Muldrow, of that group. I told her, I said, you guys exceeded my expectations when you made the choice of the superintendent that you did, because honestly, I never thought Madison would hire a black male to be its superintendent, regardless of whatever your ability is, because that's like giving up the holy grail of power. And and they did that. So but that would have not happened. I'm not kidding. That would have not happened if we didn't have people of color, a majority on that board. So it's changing, but it's only changing in large part because we are a part of changing it. We had record number of people running for state office. We now have in the last 4 years, two black people serving in our state legislature from Wisconsin. And before that, we had zero. We have more black people running for and Latinos and Asian community members like running for office in our city, our county elections. And some of these people are getting elected. So the change is on. The question is, how long will we be able to sustain that? And will, like, this pandemic we're in, you know, push us further back? Because, you know, when America goes through an economic crisis, we're the ones who are most affected by that. Mm-hmm. So it'll be, we'll have to see, can we sustain momentum in the midst of all that's going on?
You know, in 2000, you can correct me on the year, it was maybe 9 years or so ago that you had the interaction with the school board and locals about trying to start the school through the Urban League. It was going to be Madison Prep, and you had a plan for that. And that didn't go through because the school board actually denied it. And you had, I read transcripts, people coming to speak in favor of the school. There were people, you know, from the black community who were saying, this is something that we need. It felt very much like having to appeal to a power base to give you something. And then fast forward to now, you know, I don't know, it's been maybe 2 years or so. You now have a school, a different school. What changed between you trying to do Madison Prep and the one city schools that you have now? How did the conditions change?
For lack of a better analogy, some of the field Negroes got in the house.
That's a good analogy.
I mean, seriously, it was like a plantation, man. Master, could you please? Master, could you please? Or being afraid to challenge Master was what might happen to you if you say something out of line, you know? But some of us got courageous, man. And we're like, you know what? We're going to put ourselves in to change these systems. And so part of what's happened is you have things like the rise of Madison 365. You have some newspaper people like Paul Fanlon at the Capital Times. He's been their publisher editor who has, you know, he had a crisis of conscience and he started to use his newspaper, which is very popular and, you know, historic newspaper in Madison, a mainstream paper. He started writing about things. You had Pastor Alex G., one of the pastors, write a stinging article called Justified Anger. And the Capital Times published that. And that opened people's eyes. You have Doug Nelson's work and his daughter, Erica, with the Race to Equity Project, the Urban League, and who succeeded me and Ruben Anthony. They just announced a $5 million project to help Black folks buy homes in this area that's being gentrified. And you have a number of white folks that are stepping up to try to help that. And it was interesting is that they weren't talking anything about race really in 2010. It was like really quiet, where in the last mayoral election, racial equity was one of the top two agenda items. And the person that won, she's really struggled to find her place in that and has been getting herself into trouble with it, Mayor Conway, because, you know, it was like you can't just get there by, you can get there by lip service. But now, because there's this momentum in our community, people are wondering, what are you going to do? And she's feeling the heat about getting something done on that issue. So
this is your mayor?
She's our mayor. She's our mayor. Who's our mayor. And, you know, she didn't have a whole lot of connections with our community before she was mayor. But she's Madison, you know, second female mayor and, you know, smart on cities because she helped support mayors across the country in her previous work, but not really smart on our people. And so now we have a group of people, though, that are so emboldened. It's like you can't just get there and be there and bring us to the table and give us lip service. We want more than that. And we're smart. We're capable. These young activists in our community, man, they are smarter than the activists that I grew up with, you know, because of how they're doing it and how sustained their momentum is and their voice is. And so it's because we've gotten into these institutions. It's because some of the institutional leaders have finally stepped up and said, all right, we're going to be a part of that rather than this thing over here that's been holding us back. And then it's the flood of things that are just rushing through their houses to say, these things have been happening forever. And guess what? You've been a part of it. And, oh, you've been ignorant to it all these years. Mm-hmm. How dare you? You know, so people are now starting to react to that. And so we do have momentum moving forward. The question I have is, will we now make all the hard calls that we have to make to put young people in who've been a part of generations that have been held back? Are we really ready to make the real transformational decisions to help move them forward? And so with my school, the challenge for me was also I was persistent. I looked at the people who are going against me. I'm like, so I'm 38 and you're 58. If I keep myself healthy, I'm going to outlast you.
So literally, you're just going to outlive them.
Can we outlive them? Can we outlive them? You know, and but I also listen to them. But I just keep moving, man. Sometimes you got to pivot and make certain decisions to get what you need. But when we started this preschool, it was outside the realm of unions and all of that because preschool education is. And people were able to see what I was really about. That's what we're doing. And then we developed the elementary school because our university system got the ability to charter schools. We would have never gotten it through our local school system.
So wait a second. So UW is actually a charter authorizer? They can run schools?
The university has got a system which oversees all. But UW could be a charter provider because the way the Walker Law, but they put it into law, every four-year and every two-year institution, and also including tech colleges, could charter schools now if they want to.
And it feels so, like, you know, some of the biggest opposition comes out of the university, though.
Yeah, but this was a university system, and its president, Ray Cross, had been in the SUNY system before he had come to Madison. And he asked me once, I mean, we had charter schools there. Why don't we have charter schools here? And so he went to the governor and asked to be a charter authorizer, and that is who we got chartered through. So that combined with the fact that we got $1 million grant through UW Partnership Programs to study our school, we're going to do a longitudinal evaluation to look at how we're doing. There'll be interim reports put out later this year, early next year, and every year. So it's like our openness to transparency goes beyond whatever you see in a public school environment. So those things have helped get us to where we are.
You know, when I was there, when I came to visit, I went to a school called Lighthouse. I think it was called Lighthouse.
Lighthouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on the tour, I was like, man, this looks great. It's nice. It was a great facility. Very loving and caring people. The folks who were walking me around were just the nicest people, very caring, very loving. It's a place you would put your kid. So, like, if you were that type of parent who went and did a visit, which all parents I recommend should do, is you go and visit different places and get that gut feeling. So in certain places, you get the gut feeling that's like, run. Like, grab your child and run. And then other places, you're like, oh, this would be a place I would leave my kid. And Lighthouse was like that. Those kids, first of all, the amazing thing to me was that they were taking kids at 16 weeks. I was like, 16 weeks? Because I was asking them what grades or where they start with kids or whatnot. And they take kids damn near out the womb. And then they keep them. And those kids learn Mandarin. I want to say that they learn Spanish. Right. They become trilingual. They also learn about service. It's a faith-based organization, so they learn about service. They have a faith culture underneath them. And my thought when I was there was, this is amazing. Who could be against this? Like anybody who come and visit, who could be against this?
That's Marcio Sierra and Tia Sierra, man. They are a beautiful couple. I used to mentor Marcio's older brother, Rafa, who ironically, he and Marcio both came here from Honduras, I believe. And their father came here to get his education at university. And they hated the fact that they were in ESL classes and sort of shunned to the side when these were some of the smartest kids you ever would meet. And Rafa is the ambassador, deputy ambassador of the U.S. for his country now. Mm. And before that, he was the ambassador in Taiwan or one of those countries. And he came out of this community and people don't know him, but it's like, that's the family. And Marcio and his wife are so into our kids and community. And they started the school years ago. And then when the voucher came along, it allowed them to expand. But because they're a school that uses school vouchers and we can't give them any shine in Madison, we can't give the Walker administration, the previous administration, any credit for that. And we don't want vouchers. We'll let you exist as long as you're kind of quiet over there. And I know that they've had donors who want to give them money, but want to be maintained want to be quiet about it. And I understand that. I'm glad they're giving them some money. But here you have a school that deserves a lot of attention and a lot of support. And they're working with a lot of the same kids, man, that school systems are. But no one will go over there to try to learn from them because they're taking a voucher. And that's mm-hmm. totally against the liberal thinking in this community. Whereas I like, make me a part of the videos. I'll go out and advocate for you. I don't care what these people think. These people are crazy. They'll support 40, 50 years of black and brown underachievement and think that I'm supposed to be standing over there with them when I'm going to come over here and stand with you.
Well, I want to ask you kind of a tough question now, because it's all, to me, each of these stories from one progressive city to another, the story has a pretty similar mix of individuals, actors, and players that are involved. And I just want to test this one on Madison a little bit. So in each of these markets, you definitely have the white mom who is very sympathetic to the white teachers in the classroom, which means that they are very often in concert with the white teachers union, not because they believe in unionism just by itself, but just because it's a compact made of similarity. They sympathize with each other, right? So they sympathize with each other and then they become a power block. And that oftentimes, as good as people are and as nice as they are and as much as they voted for Obama, they actually become really illiberal in what they vote for in terms of policy. But that's not to let black folks off the hook, too, because in each of these places, I will notice that there is a contingent of black folks, too, who don't want to privatize. They want to give you lectures about neoliberalism like the others do. They want to talk to you as if these are our schools. Oh, my God, they're busting up our schools. And some of them will do it with a very like Afrocentric standpoint too. Some will do it just because they're in the system and they're being paid and they have pensions in the system. Right. Others will do it with the daishiki on, with the raised fist talking about these are our schools. We're not going to let anybody come in and give our families choice. Do you have that contingent in Madison?
Yes, but it's small. Yes, but it's small.
Not a big one. Well, you're lucky if it's small.
Yeah, no, trust me, because I've worked on choice issues for a long time. People don't know this. I haven't written anything about it, but I crack up every time I see something written about the school voucher program or charter schools in D.C. Because my job, man, after I left as the founding president of the Black Alliance for Educational Options with Howard Fuller, I was their founding CEO. I was working closely with John Walton and Jim Blue and different people like that in D.C., along with the local leadership there. And my job was to help get that school voucher program in the city. And that's not what we originally intended. It was going to be private. But Raul Fernandez is one of the owners of the Wizards. He's a young dude back then. He asked a question. We were in a meeting with Don Graham of the Washington Post and a bunch of other people talking about how we can help things in D.C. move forward. He has, why don't we try for a public program? I mean, we got a sympathetic legislature for that at the, you know, in the government, federal government. And so my job was to lead that three sector effort, which was to get all that money to help support the public charter and the private, you know, the school voucher program. And then we launched the voucher program and whatnot in that city. So I say that because coming back to there was a lot of that in D.C. at the time. And I understood it more there because of the deep rooted nature of the federal government just running that city, you know, the whole situation of home rule. So I was like, all like, these are my people, you know, and I can get why they are struggling with this idea. So I got in trouble with some people on the right because they were like they had their own agenda. They were trying to push with vouchers and stuff for years. Well, what I did is I just went through the route. I went through the black churches. I went through black leadership in the city council, business people. I wanted to make sure their voices were at the table. And that's how we got to where we are. But I understood the black voice that pushed against it there. When I got here and I heard the black voices pushing against it, it didn't make as much sense to me, man, where it felt like they had been so co-opted by whoever their friends were, or the people they worked for were, that they started to buy the same message. That somehow the right wing was taking over or going to take over. But I'm like, look at, you don't have a right wing leadership in Dane County. You just don't. They make up maybe 25%, 30% of the electorate, if that. These are all white liberals running and been doing it for years. And we are in a worse state than the kids in Washington, D.C. are. So what's up with that? So I can't tell you, man. I looked at it and said, as I looked at some of the people, and said they believe what they believe. And you know, you still got to love these folks, right? But the source of their beliefs, I really think were wed to their cultural orientation. You know, you can be black and not have the same culture as other black people from block to block. And so their culture was just very different than my own. I came from that, we're going to push culture. My family were all activists and vocal and, you know, we're all about the black community all the time. And so people couldn't see that. How could you be for school vouchers and for black people? And my question coming back was, how can you be for this liberal progressive establishment and be for black people when black people are suffering under their leadership? And so I just felt it was a cultural disconnect that I felt more when I came back home than when I was in D.C. I could understand people's fears and push against the system there and against what we were doing, which is why we tried to work as closely with those folks as possible to make it the way they wanted it done. Whereas when I came home, that message didn't work here.
Well, when white liberals form a power block in a city like Madison or the Twin Cities or Seattle or wherever else, they adopt a language that is like all about civil rights, progressivism, equity. It was like one of their favorite words, equity, over and over again. You'll hear that. And then they'll have someone come to them from the black community appealing for an alternative to their rule, something that, you know, to an educational option outside of them. And one of the ways that they do put that down is, well, twofold. One, they go and find the black folks that are so invested in the current system that they'll come and have a Mandingo fight with anybody who's trying to have any, like, you know, change. But the other way will be this narrative around, well, you're just a sellout. You're just paid by the right wing to say these things that you're saying, you know, and it'll be a weird kind of dual consciousness that you'll have as a black person. Like, it'll be weird. Like, so all my lived experiences wiped away, you think? You know, you're going to erase all of my lived experience as a white person sitting there by using the words neoliberalism and privatization and working for the right wing and invoking the name of the Waltons and all that. Does that really, do you really think that that's a successful strategy? And the truth is, it is kind of successful, isn't it?
It is. It is successful. I mean, it was successful with some folks with me. There were still early on, I think it's changed a lot now. But there was still early on, some black people were like, well, I don't know, Kaleem, you know, as if our voices, like, I got to somehow, when you get white people with money, that I'm now going to be weak, you know, like, I'm not going to be who I am and I'm not going to say what I'm going to say and I'm going to be disingenuous around them because they're white people with power, with money. Man, I wasn't raised scared like that, you know, and I was vocal as I am now, the same way with them. And what I do is I just looked at it and said, what's the greatest avenue for Black people to get some power and authority here and to have a say in the education of our children? And that we can actually create that. And I've been wanting to create my own school since I was 17, man. It was hard growing up here. I never had a Black teacher in Madison, Wisconsin growing up, ever. And I didn't get one until it was Effie Berry, Mayor M. Berry's ex-wife, when I was at Hampton University. She was my health teacher. And that was the first place I had Black educator. But I've always had the same voice. And so people, it's like they can't see your individual personal power throughout being sanctioned or supported by these other people in the system. It's like they don't move me. They don't rule me. I believe what I believe. Maybe they do some people, but not this brother, you know? And so it that's been the struggle I've had since I've been in this work in education or advocacy, is you do have people who look at you because of how far you can move an agenda and wondering somebody's got to be backing you or helping you. And, you know, that, or they won't trust you. So what I did with this school, too, I didn't get any national support, any support outside of Madison for our schools. We're now going into our sixth year of our preschool, our third year of our charter. I got it all locally. And it was over $10 million.
Mm.
And so then I finally got some money from the Walton Family Foundation and Charter School Growth Fund last year, which we desperately needed and happy that we got. But it was to show people that, no, I'm not led by a right wing. I'm not even the highest paid person in my schools, man. And I founded them. I'm tied for fourth, bro. You know, and it's like when you're starting a startup, sometimes it's like that. You're trying to get the best people you can find. But the people who are like, oh, he's just doing it for the money. No, I could be making a lot more money. I know that, doing other things. But I'm that convicted to change them, to change things for our kids. Because, as you said, no education, we're not going to solve the problem of housing disparities and income disparities and wealth gaps if our children, only 15 to 20% or less of our kids, can read at grade level by the time they graduate high school. It's that simple. And we've got people who run around here talking about everything, man, and don't focus enough on that.
I think that's what gets really hard in progressive cities, is to keep people with their eye on the prize. The eye on the prize is these numbers. These numbers, like, we live in a math society with a bunch of people who can't do math, but I can do math. And that's when you have numbers like you just said, those numbers to me, that with those equal fewer jobs, fewer houses, less income, less home loans, less mortgages, all of that, worse interest rates on cars, just keep going down the list, worst health outcomes, all the disparities that we talk about have math beneath them. And that math is easily predicted by the number of students that can't read in third grade, fourth grade, eighth grade, can't do eighth grade math, can't graduate high school prepared for college. Even when they go to college, they need remediation, and only like a handful come out the other end with a damn college degree. As one part of society is not having that exact same math underneath their problem. So how you would even have to stand before a group of folks in a city that are lording over that problem and defend yourself? Like, where your money comes from. Damn it, you can pull up my 990 and talk about my salary all day long. First of all, I don't work for free. Neither do you. Nobody ever coming at me is a free worker. And if they are, they married well. So, like you know, either married well or they had parents that actually married well. So, so this idea that we either need to work for free and be in poverty, or we're not true to the people who are oppressing us, is a weird one to me. And I only bring this up because I wonder what you and I and others do to prepare the next wave of fighters who are going to be fighting for the same things we fight for, to confront that and put it down quickly. Don't let it become the thing that dogs you, or let it work with you. What do you think about when you think about the next group of people coming up to prepare them to have those battles with the power establishment, with white progressive and others?
It's funny you say that, because about 4 or 5 years ago, I started feeling like, man, there's more I could be doing to help, you know. So I started working behind some of the folks in our local community that have organizations. I'm not going to say their names. I'm never going to disempower their great efforts. But they would come to me and like, man, how do you raise money? How do you do this? How do you structure your presentations and proposals? How are you raising all that money? So I would just quietly work behind them and bring them over to my house or whatever. We'd go through some planning sessions. And in the midst of that, the conversation, like, they've never seen a weak brother when they look at me. ever. Mm-hmm. They've never said that, and they never will. And I don't mean, that doesn't mean that I won't agree with people that I might disagree with. I can be moved. I can be changed. My views can be changed. But you got to have, it's got, it takes an effort. You got to help me understand things. But I don't have to change who I am. And I can still move forward, and they can see you get knocked down and get right back up. And so I think that's important, to live your life openly like that too, so people can see that, you know, that through this effort, if you're going to win anything, you're going to go through some challenges, but you can keep moving. And so seeing that is really important. So the worst thing I could do was then just say, all right, I give up. I could have gave up after that charter school. And then people would have been like, see, we can't get nothing done in this community. But it's like, no, I just took a different position and took a different angle and amassed a different support group, too. The people that started this school with me, the Sue Cruz, the Sally Martiniak, people like that, they're still with me, man. And they weren't concerned about my so-called affiliations, whether they were real or not, before. They wanted to support these children. And so even they being at the table, for the reasons they were and the people that they helped bring along, like, wait a minute, yeah, we don't have to be concerned about all that BS. You know, we got to be concerned about the children. And so what we've done now in our city, man, is pretty extraordinary. You know, we're doing well as a school, even through this pandemic. It's going to be crazy to see, because we're going back in person and virtual. We let parents choose which one they wanted to do, because our baby's got to be in a classroom, you know. They're not going to be selected into a lot of these pods. Their parents aren't even going to have the money to be in these pods to pay teachers to do the work. And fortunately, we still have support from our community for that. And it's building. But, man, I'm ready to do more. You know, one thing I told them, I'm going to help take on this leadership and make sure that charter schools are able to continue to support children in the state, because we as a Black people, we need that avenue in order to be able to produce something different for our kids in this state. So I'm going to have a larger voice on that. Well, at the same time, preschool education, I believe it should be free to every kid in this state, regardless of race or income. Public education is, but we're on the free market till age 5, right? And if our parents can support something positive, we can have a positive nurturing as young children. That type of, that shouldn't exist. Mm. We should be able to cover the cost of that. So We got to keep pushing our agenda, man, and be consistent and be pliable, you know, be willing to look at things and say, OK, maybe I got that wrong. But at the same time, we can't get knocked down and not get back up. That will stop any movement.
Well, I think that's a good place for us to wrap on, too. And I definitely would love to have you come back over time and keep talking. We're about to publish a blog post that you allowed us to publish that I think has like just one of the most elegant and awesome breakdowns of the 365 to 400 year battle that we have had for an education. And it kind of, I think, arrives at a point of saying we shouldn't have to beg for this. This should just be our right to get what we need. So we'll be publishing that on Citizen Ed soon. But I do want to wrap with just like a minute or two from you on what you just talked about. Maybe a decade or less, tried to start a school. It didn't go well. You put a lot of time, effort, and blood, sweat, and tears into it. And that could have been, that not going through could have been the thing that made you say, I'm done. I'm going to walk away from this. Now we're talking about a new model that you have and a school and whatnot. So you stuck with it. I want someone in another city to hear that and think about that. But this new One City Schools that you have, someone listening and watching, what was the theory of change around that that you think makes it the way to go, makes it successful, and that someone else somewhere else can replicate?
We looked at all the research on education going back, you know, years, and looked at what are the things that they say define a great experience for children. And we looked at not only research, but we looked at practice. Some practices aren't always researched. And so I visited a bunch of schools around the country. I looked at the research. I talked to people who've been practitioners and researchers. And we said, OK, we're going to build a school that has, you know, a healthy meals program where we have a full time chef and a cook cooking for our kids every day because diet matters, that we're going to have a longer school day, longer school year to overcome this persistence of achievement gap, but not just doing the same old things in those longer school days, longer school years, but providing more intensive support at different times of the year, but also great experiences. We have academies. Our kids are taking martial arts and doing art and dance and drumming and all that stuff. Things, and we have a soccer academy, things that they could not afford out in the local community. We can afford it here. So we are going to build those things in, great teachers, leaders, you know, and fund that. And we have two teachers in every classroom through second grade because we know a lot of our kids come and they need that additional help. And they're all taught to teach. So even my assistant teachers go through the same teacher training as the teachers do. And the teachers define the curriculum, but the assistant teachers can actually teach it. And we're trying to grow our own teachers that way, too. We have one that just completed their practice test. And so we're growing our own. So charter schools give us the ability to create that environment for our young people in ways that it's harder to do through these big traditional public school systems. But what we are also open to is we're open to public scrutiny and critique. We are very transparent. I send every report, every quarterly report to every city council person, county board person, whether they like charter schools or not. We've invited people in. Our former teachers union leadership, Doug Keylor, he came in and toured the school and was blown away that, yeah, this is a real school, man. And when the newspapers asked him last year, what do you think about one city? Or he said about charters. They're like, look, we're not down with independent charter schools, et cetera. And then when they asked, well, what about one city? So, well, that one, you know, he had to say what he saw. And so I just tell people that, you know, don't get caught up in these arguments for or against the Democratic Party's really going against charter schools now, which they started. It's crazy for me, but we have to do what's best for our children and our local communities, regardless of how we get there. And if you don't like the way charter schools are structured, then co-opt them. You know what I'm saying? Like, build the kind of schools that use it as a vehicle to build the kind of schools that we need, rather than just shooting it down and sticking with the model that you got, because the model that you got is not getting us there. So that's what I would say, brother, because I could go on and on and on. But we've got to create schools that are customized to what our children need. And so everything in my school, I tell people, I get too much credit for vision, because I wasn't trying to just cast my vision and what I think is important. I was looking at, well, what is working? And how much of that, I'm more of an architect, how much of that can I build into my school? And we've had challenges, you know, with behavior and things like that, but it's like, but we go at it, man. You know, we try to make things work. And so I'm really excited about this upcoming school year too. So anybody wants to learn from us, you don't have to go to our website. Just go there, reach out to us. We'll talk to you and we'll share whatever. Oh, I tell you, we'll share everything that we've got. Budgets, every only thing I won't share is how much my employees make, because you don't need to know their business.
we just dropped the link to onecityschools.org in the comments here so that people can see it. Your Twitter handle has been going throughout the show beneath. It's at Care Kaleem on Twitter. And so we want people to be in touch and to share. Like, share across city lines, state lines, whatever is working. That's the way it happened with Black education in history, was across city and state lines. Black educators and others were sharing information with each other that made them all better. So I appreciate you, man. I want you to come back again. I want to keep talking.
Too, brother. Absolutely. Yeah. Anytime.
Yeah, I want to keep talking.